Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're remembering the life and music of the high priestess of soul, Nina Simone.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood was one of the many songs that Nina Simone helped popularize and a song that she felt was autobiographical. Jazz diva Nina Simone died on Monday. She was 70 years old. Born Eunice Kathleen Wayman in Tryon, North Carolina in 1933, Nina Simone dreamt of becoming a classical pianist, a big dream for an African-American woman growing up in the Jim Crow American South during the 1940s and 50s. But it was while she was supporting herself as a nightclub pianist and singer, she found her true calling as a jazz singer, and she became a legend. Nina Simone's life and music were deeply affected by the racial injustices in America. Throughout the music world, she was the high priestess of soul. In her adopted country of France, she was dubbed Queen Nina. And to many African-American women, she represented a symbol of hope and of strength. Tonight, we're remembering the great singer, Nina Simone, through her music. Joining us now from Los Angeles, California, is David Nathan, a singer-songwriter and author of Soulful Divas, Personal Portraits of Over a Dozen Divas. Welcome, David Nathan.
Hi. How you doing, Bob?
I'm well, thank you, and thanks for joining us. We're also joined tonight by Gabrielle Goodman, a singer and songwriter who's performed with Chaka Khan, Al Jarreau, and Roberta Flack, a professor of voice at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, Gabrielle Goodman.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you very much, and thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
David, let me ask you the first question. Talk about Nina Simone's young life. What were her musical ambitions early on?
Probably her earliest years were spent in church. Very earliest years, which since her mother was a minister, both her parents actually were ministers. And so I think the most fundamental, earliest influence was actually gospel music. At that same time, around the age of three, she learned to play the piano. She didn't learn to play the piano. She went to the piano and was able to play immediately. So she was a child prodigy. And so her earliest years were spent alternating between going to church and hearing her mom minister and being tutored in classical music by an English woman who lived in the town that she was in, Tryon, North Carolina. So Nina was, I guess, betwixt two worlds, the world of gospel music and the world of classical music. And I think those were the earliest influences on her, and that's what helped shape her entire life.
But at the outset, she wanted to be a classical pianist and studied briefly at Juilliard. How come she never became one?
Well, she did study at Juilliard, and then she applied for a scholarship to the Curtis Music Institute in Philadelphia, and she was denied, and she did not get to study at Curtis. And it was as a result of that that she found herself unemployed and needing to support herself. She was in Philadelphia. She had moved to Philadelphia from North Carolina, and her family had moved too. So it was like almost by default that she became a singer and pianist in a nightclub, playing jazz, standards, torch songs of the day, pop songs, in order to supplement her income. So it was not her original plan. It was never her dream to become a popular recording artist. So it was like a career by default. And I think even to the end of her life, and I can recall a conversation with her maybe two or three years ago, and which she still expressed her bitterness that she was denied the dream of becoming a classical pianist. And she always felt that it was due to racism, And we'll never know really what it was. It could have been that. It could have been that they simply didn't feel that she was qualified. We'll never know the real truth about that story. But the bottom line is that her not becoming a classical pianist gave us a whole life and career, which, of course, we all have been touched and moved by.
Tell us this story briefly. She was born with the name Eunice Wayman. Where did Nina Simone come from?
Oh, that's a great story. When she started to perform, originally actually at the outset in Atlantic City, it was the first gig she ever had, and she did not want her family to find out that she was performing in a nightclub. So she adopted the name Simone from out of admiration for a French actress, Simone Signoret. And Nina was actually a pet name given to her by a Hispanic boyfriend she had at the time. So Eunice Wayman transformed into Nina Simone, I guess, for the purposes of performance, and that's who she was for the rest of her life.
You could say that, in a way, she was destined for stardom from day one, at least when it came to recording music, because one of her first recorded songs, I Loves You Porky, became her first top 20 hit in 1957, and then amazingly, her only top 40 entry for her entire career in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to hear that right now.
I love you, Porgy. Don't let him handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay with you forever, and I'll be glad. Yes, I love you, Porgy. Don't let him take me. Don't let him handle me with his hot hands. If you can keep me, I want to stay here with you forever. I've got my man.
Gabrielle Goodman, tell me what you hear in this voice that means so much to you.
Oh, it's a wonderful voice. It's a voice that encompasses the roots of African American music, spirituals, gospel, jazz. The phrasing has all of those things in it, and the timbre and the color of it just gives an inkling of what she has been through as an African American woman in the United States. She was a tremendous artist and someone whom I had amazing respect for. And the thing that made her so great is that she was classically trained. You know, I had several conversations with Roberta Flack, who had been through the same thing. She was trained as a classical pianist. She was not trained as a singer initially. She was trained as a classical pianist. And the doors were simply not open to her to become a classical musician at that point. So she, too, had a career by default in popular music, and she was influenced by Nina Simone in many, many ways.
I'm wondering what Nina Simone's career means to you as a vocalist.
Well, first of all, she, as an African-American female musician, means a lot to me because, first of all, she was an educated woman. She was an educated musician. She was someone who could not only perform the music of my culture or of our culture, but she could also perform traditional music. She could also perform classical music, and you hear those elements in her music as well. And she carried herself and her music with so much pride. She was not afraid to speak the truth. She was not afraid to express her political ideas through music and just in speaking with reporters and various people who would interview her. There's so much history that one can even hear and learn when you listen to The King of Love is Dead or Mississippi Goddamn or Baltimore. You learn a lot about what was going on in the latter part of the 1960s and the early 70s when there was so much turmoil in the United States in terms of the civil rights movement.
We want to play another Nina Simone song now, and let's talk about it just a little bit before we hear about it. It's My Baby Just Cares for Me, recorded early in her career with minimal success, but it later became a major hit in Britain 30 years later because of a commercial. David, can you tell us the story about this song?
It was on Nina's first album, which came out in 1959, and I think it had originally been recorded by Frank Sinatra. And it was an album cut, so it wasn't really a big deal to Nina. I don't think she performed it at all, other than maybe occasionally in a nightclub. And when she was one of her first visits to Britain, she performed at a small club in South London, which was mostly frequented by Jamaican clients. So most of the audience was Jamaican. And they had latched onto this song because it had a little bit of a ska-like beat. So it had a kind of a Caribbean flavor to it in the way Nina was playing the piano. And they came to the club to hear her sing that song. And they started to yell and scream that they wanted to hear it. And Nina didn't understand what they were yelling and screaming about. And so she stormed off stage and went backstage. And I had to explain to her that they wanted to hear that song. And her response is not repeatable on the air, but it was something along the lines of, I'm not playing that piece of, and you can fill in the blank. And we had to convince her that if she didn't go out and sing the song, it was going to be a riot. So she grudgingly obliged. And then, of course, ironically, 30 years later, as you said, the song was used in a commercial and became one of her biggest hits and became an absolute integral part of her repertoire. So there was a little bit of irony in the way that it all turned out.
It was in a Chanel perfume commercial. Let's hear it now.
Liz Taylor is not a star, and even Lana Turner smile. Something he can't see. My baby don't care. Who knows? My baby just cares for me.
Gabrielle Goodman, talk about this song and the early Nina Simone style that we're hearing here.
Oh, the early Nina Simone style, as David said, was filled with lots of different sounds and textures, some from the Caribbean, some from the roots of spirituals and from gospel music, and you hear all of those different styles in her singing and in her piano playing. this song really gives you an idea of all of those things coming together.
We're remembering the life and the career and the music of the great Nina Simone tonight. Let's go into the break by listening to one of the great Torch songs she recorded back in 1964, The Other Woman. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in tonight for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And as the years go by, the other woman will spare my
BUR.org. Sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're remembering the life and music of the great Nina Simone.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. And I mean every word of it. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet.
Mississippi Goddamn, Nina Simone's very first original protest song. Nina Simone died this week at the age of 70, and helping us tonight remember the High Priestess of Soul. We're joined in Los Angeles by David Natham, a singer-songwriter and author of Soulful Divas, personal portraits of over a dozen divas, and by Gabrielle Goodman, a singer and professor of voice at the Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. Gabrielle, tell us how the civil rights movement affected Nina Simone's music.
Well, it affected her in such a way that obviously she decided to give it a voice in terms of music, in terms of actually speaking about the injustices through her music, through song. And I think that's a wonderful thing. She and James Brown did that. I can remember hearing Mississippi Goddamn when I was a child. Didn't really know what it was about. I fully embraced To Be Young, Gifted, and Black at the time because it was just such an empowering song for a youth to hear at that time growing up. It just made you feel special when the whole world was telling you, I don't know that you're so special because of the color of your skin. I don't know if it's possible for you to do these, whatever your aspirations were. When you heard this song, you just felt as if you could do anything. So I think she was a magnificent writer and a magnificent political voice.
You know, for a protest song, for an angry protest song, yeah. It's kind of upbeat.
Yeah, it is. But, I mean, you have some blues songs that are upbeat, you know, but they still are speaking about difficult times, trying times. So a lot of our music in the African-American community, even though it may not necessarily have a slow beat to it, you may feel a little happy from hearing it, but you also get the idea of something that's lying just beneath the surface where you can kind of get an idea that something isn't right and something needs to be changed in terms of what's going on politically.
David, she was bubbling with anger at this time. Tell us about that.
Certainly in my conversations with her early on, around that time, the first time I met her was in 1965, when I was running a fan club in Britain for the first time. And, you know, we did talk briefly about how she felt about, you know, what was inspiring her to sing those kind of songs. And she had experienced firsthand racism. She knew of what she spoke, and she was very committed that things would not stay this way. And she was obviously a peer of people like Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and and so on. And so she was determined, committed personally, the civil rights movement would work and that people would experience equality. And she was one of the very first fearless people to put a voice to that through music. Many other performers at the time backed off. They would not walk the talk. They spoke, they talked the talk, but they wouldn't walk the walk. And Nina did that at great personal risk. I mean, her music was banned in Mississippi as a result of the song Mississippi Goddamn. There were threats. I mean, she wasn't just walking out there just saying what she said with no repercussions. And so it was, it, you know, this, we have to look into the time period and see what it was. And it was very risky for someone to stand up and say something and to use the word goddamn, which is a cuss word.
And she did actually stand up. It wasn't only in her music. I read a little bit of her autobiography, I Put a Spell on You, and there was a paragraph in there which I think perfectly demonstrated exactly how full of fire she was at this point. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to just read it. One time in New York, I went to see an off-Broadway play with Bill Dukes and Brock Peters, two fine black actors in the cast. I thought the roles they played were insulting to black people, and I got up there in the middle of the show on stage and told them so. I stopped the play in its tracks to ask them why they were doing trash like that. One of them said something about needing the money. That was no excuse. They apologized. They took me home in a cab. I was half crazed with anger that night, a woman on fire. And that was how I felt most of the time as I watched my people struggling for their rightful place in America. Nina Simone, in her own words, in her autobiography, I Put a Spell on You. David, why was she so passionate about it?
I think if you really want to know the truth, the real bottom line of it is that because of what she grew up with, coming from the segregated South and being denied her own dream, I think if the source, the root of much of that anger was that she had personally been denied her dream of being a classical pianist, becoming a world-famous classical pianist, and that she was denied that, she always said was because of racism, and it deeply, deeply affected her life. And I think that's what it, that was, that had to have a tremendous impact on how she dealt with her own life. And her, I think that she felt just it was incumbent on her to be a part of a movement that would make change, and that she wanted to use the platform of being an entertainer to make the point, to make sure people knew. And that was it. And there were probably other reasons. I mean, I can speculate, you know, that in addition to that kind of passion, I mean, Nina was a passionate person, period, about everything in life. So it wasn't just about that. That's just what fueled her life. She was passionate. And I think that that was just who she was. And she just infused that passion into this particular arena with complete justification. I mean, I think she felt that it was just wrong. And it was.
Let's listen to another song addressing the black plight, a song about four women whose circumstances and outlook are related to the subtle gradations in skin color.
My skin is black. My arms are long. My hair is woolly. My back is strong. Strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah. My name is Aunt Sarah. Aunt Sarah. My skin is yellow. My hair is long. Between two worlds, I do belong. My father was rich and white. He forced my mother late night.
what do they call me? My name is Sophronia.
The lyrics, written by Nina Simone, were widely misunderstood at the time. The song was actually banned on certain radio stations in the U.S. because they said it was, quote, unquote, insulting to black people. Gabrielle Goodman, I'm wondering what you felt as a woman when you listened to this song.
I didn't feel that it was, I mean, from just from my memory of it, didn't feel that it was insulting. Again, I was a child then, but we come in so many different colors and packages as African Americans, and I just feel that she was expressing that. I also guess that this was another source of her rage. She was not a light-skinned woman. And when you are dealing with a situation where people may feel that it's easier to deal with someone whose skin is a little bit lighter, and especially at that time in the 60s and the early 70s, then I'm sure that when the 50s and even earlier than that, I'm sure all of her life she had to deal with certain people dealing with her in a specific way because her skin was dark, or medium brown skin at least. People deal with you in a different way when you, I mean, depending on the color of your skin, depending on whether you're a lighter skinned black woman or a darker skinned black woman, or African American men deal with that as well. And I just feel that she was expressing that in that song. I don't think it was insulting. I just think she was expressing the truth.
David Nathan, did Nina Simone feel that she was misunderstood a lot in her life?
Yes. I would say she felt that she was misunderstood a lot. And I think part of the point that Gabrielle makes is very cogent, and that's actually true. I think that in addition to, you know, dealing with how people would relate to her because of the color of her skin, it also was because of her features. She had very strong African features, and she didn't look like the traditional female black vocalist of the time. And when we think about the African-American vocalists of that day, female vocalists, we think of people like Nancy Wilson or Ella Fitzgerald or Carmen McRae. You know, we're talking about women who were of a lighter skin and did not have the kind of strong African features that Nina had. And I think that put her in a kind of defensive mode a lot, because I think people related to her differently because of that. She didn't look like a Hollywood star, for sure.
She was not necessarily loved by the recording industry, universally loved by the recording industry. There was a time in 1977 when she was booed off the stage at a music trade show when she lectured the record executives, telling them, quote, "I'm a genius, not a clown. Most of your people out there are all crooks." It makes me wonder if she was ever satisfied. Do you think she was ever satisfied with the business end of her career? Was she ever as successful as she thought she should be?
Absolutely not. And you know, some of that was her own doing. I mean, let's be straight, real about it. It wasn't always the music industry. She wasn't an easy person to work with in regards to the industry itself. But with some justification, again, I mean, she was not the earliest part of her career. She signed a contract which would deny her the royalties for her earliest recordings. She obviously was an artist of the first order, and so her approach to recording was that she was going to record what she wanted to record, and so it was the whole issue of integrity. And she wasn't easily marketed. I mean, this was a woman who would go from singing an African chant to an Israeli folk song, you know, from Jacques Brel to Burt Bacharach, and that's a very vast diversity of music to cover and not easy to market. So, you know, she wasn't an easy person to work with in that respect. And she did feel ripped off. Now, ultimately, and this is the good side of life, with the invention of the CD and compact discs, she was able, through a great lawyer, to have some of her contracts renegotiated. And ultimately, Nina was victorious because she ended up selling over 1 million compact discs from her RCA catalog, which was phenomenal. That's worldwide. So there was a bittersweet victory. And so while in her earliest days she certainly felt that she was victimized and did not get the kind of success she could have, ultimately she was victorious.
Well, I think that most artists are not happy with what they receive from what, you know, from the works that they issue. And I'm sure that Nina Simone was not alone in that. She was just probably very vocal about it. a lot of people don't come to the forefront and speak on it, and I'm sure that she just was probably very vocal about that. I remember being in Europe a few years back and having someone to come to a gathering that was being held for us when I was with Roberta Flack, and someone was talking about My Baby Just Cares For Me, and they were saying, oh, we've got this song, and isn't it great that right now Nina Simone isn't getting a dime for it? And we all looked at this person in just utter disbelief. And we thought, this is a travesty. It's horrible. So obviously she must have been able to recover the money for that as it sold, which I'm really happy to hear that.
Yeah,
because
so there was sweet justice in the end.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, part of her success toward the end of the career came from the fact that her catalog ended up with a wide variety of musical styles in it, though, didn't it? And her popularity branched away out with a lot of people.
Yeah, one of the things that really was interesting, I think there was some irony to this, and I think she felt that there was irony to it, too, was that a lot of her music was used in a film called Point of No Return. So I think around the beginning of the 90s. And Nina was actually kind of in the film, not personally, but she was referenced in the film. And almost all the whole soundtrack from the film, which was quite successful, was her music. And this introduced her to a whole other generation of music buyers. And she just, I don't really know what that, and just in general, people just seem to have discovered her. Of course, there are many artists of today who have mentioned her as an influence. Lauryn Hill, Jill Scott, India Arie, different people have mentioned her. Diane Reeves, I mean, many people have mentioned Nina as an influence, and I think that kind of publicity has seeped down, and people have wanted to find out, well, who is this woman, Nina Simone? And it's led to the fact that her catalog has been made widely available on compact disc, and so there's been a renaissance. In fact, when she toured here a few years ago, it was to sold-out houses everywhere, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, New York. Everywhere she went was complete sellout. And I think the composition of the audience was interesting because it was some of her traditional fans from way back from the 50s and 60s, as well as this whole group of younger black, white, Latino, every mixture culture and ethnicity that were much younger, you know, in the 20s and 30s. And I think it was very heartening for her to get that kind of response after having been gone from the country for such a long time.
Among the songs she covered by a wide variety of artists, including the Bee Gees and Bob Dylan, is this one from George Harrison, Nina Simone singing Here Comes the Sun. We'll be right back. I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're remembering the life and music of the High Priestess of Soul, Nina Simone, who died Monday at age 70. This is I Put a Spell on You.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. You better stop the things you do.
As we remember Nina Simone tonight, we're talking to David Nathan, a singer-songwriter and author of Soulful Divas, personal portraits of over a dozen divas, and by Gabrielle Goodman, a singer and professor of voice at Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. David, I Put a Spell on You is the title of her autobiography, and I know that you consider this song one of her greatest recordings. Why?
I really do, because I think it really captures every element of Nina Simone. There's these jazz runs, jazz vocal runs that she does. You know, there's this mystical, you know, otherworldly sound in her voice. There's a little bit of a bite. The orchestration is fabulous. You know, the string section there. You can hear her piano right up front. And it's just an extraordinary performance. I mean, the emotion at the end of that song is just unbelievable. I mean, the first time I heard it, I was like, oh, man, that has to be one of the greatest recordings I've ever heard.
Gabrielle Goodman, do you share David Nathan's enthusiasm about this piece?
Oh, I think it's amazing. Captures all that she's capable of doing, and it does encompass all of those different styles as well.
We've been calling her tonight the High Priestess of Soul. Someone did label her that, but she rather rejected that title, I think, because she thinks it didn't do her justice in relation to paying respect to the full range of her expertise.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I mean, it was a great marketing title. I mean, you have to remember this is at the time in the 60s when we had the Godfather of Soul, James Brown. We had the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. So it was a convenient marketing tool to call Nina the High Priestess, because she certainly had the elements of being a high priestess. There was something menacing about her, too, sometimes. She was a little witch-like, and there was a whole voodoo flavor to how she would, you know, appear and just her whole manner. She could be a little intimidating in person, you know, person to person. But I think that you're quite correct. I mean, High Priestess of Soul really does not say all that Nina Simone was. I mean, she really, for me, was the only artist I'd ever heard who was completely boundless.
What she was feeling later in life, later in her career, when she was living in France and had gone through several marriages and men who, frankly, beat her, showed up in a weary way in her later work, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, she lived a very full life, sometimes a sad life. But you know what? If you listen to even her earliest recordings, there's this kind of weariness.
Absolutely.
This kind of world weariness.
Absolutely.
I think that, more than anything, is that element in her voice is what drew people, because all of us can have the experience of being weary. And there's a certain kind of, you know, there was something, she had a very lived-in voice from the beginning.
Let's listen to a song that might demonstrate that for us. It's titled, My Man's Gone Now.
My man's gone now. Ain't no use of listening. For his tired footsteps climbing up the stairs.
Gabrielle, as she hangs on to those notes at the end of those words, you can really feel the pain in some of her life.
Yes, you can. You can tell that she connects. She absolutely connects with the song. You know, and this is a Gershwin piece that's from Porgy and Bess. Many people have performed it, but she actually ultimately brings the message home in her performance more than anyone else. And you can hear all of the sorrow in her spirit and in her sound here.
Let me ask both of you how you feel she'll be remembered. Gabrielle, why don't you start?
I feel at this point that she will probably be revered now more than she ever had been, which is sad in some ways and good that people will really start to recognize the contributions that she has made to music and the contributions that she has made to society in terms of her political statements. I hope that people will understand her. They will understand what she was trying to say in her music. They will understand what she was trying to say as an African-American woman who was struggling to make it as an artist in a time where a lot of the doors were closed to her. But I hope that she will be remembered as someone who triumphed over adversity. And I believe that ultimately that she will be remembered as someone who did triumph over adversity.
And David Nathan, quickly, Nina Simone remembered.
As an artist with absolute integrity, who was fearless in approaching music and would go wherever her emotions led, and was willing to expose herself, expose her soul, bare her soul through her music, and as an artist who's affected and influenced countless others. And I think that's the legacy that Nina Simone's music will continue on, and it is really timeless music.
David Nathan, Gabrielle Goodman, thank you.
Thank you
so much for the opportunity to share and talk about Nina Simone.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's been wonderful.
Gabrielle Goodman, professor of voice at Berklee College of Music, a singer and songwriter, and David Nathan, author of Soulful Divas, Personal Portraits of Over a Dozen Divas. Continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. And let's close the show now by listening to Nina Simone singing Young, Gifted, and Black. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
We will not be threatened. We will not respond to threats. We look for a way forward that will eliminate this threat and put North Korea on a path to a better future.
I have a good feeling about this. I'm sort of a glass half full guy, not a glass half empty guy. So I think security is getting better. I think public services are getting better. And I think in very short order, you'll see a change in the attitudes and the will of the people themselves.
Sometimes they voluntarily walk up and say, look, I'm on your list and I want to get some credit for turning myself in. Some cases, someone down the street says, go look over in that house. And in some cases, they're just scooped up in a random effort. But we're gathering them in every day.
We were, quite frankly, sandbagged, I think, by the WHO. And we are taking every step, and so is the federal government, as possible to reverse this decision.
Some in Congress say the plan is too big. Well, it seems like to me they might have some explaining to do. If they agree that tax relief creates jobs, then why are they for a little bitty tax relief package?
We pass a law requiring every employer to provide access to quality coverage with employer tax credits covering most of the cost. And we pay for it by repealing the Bush tax cut.
The president abused Chairman Greenspan as a very wise fiscal, a very wise monetary steward. Chairman Greenspan has a very steady hand at the helm of monetary policies for our country. He has a very good judgment, sound judgment, that is reassuring both to the president and to markets.
The bigger picture here is re-engaging in the peace process. The bigger picture is the introduction of the roadmap. And for the bigger interest of the Palestinian people, I think every effort should be exerted in order to enable Abu Mazen to succeed in submitting his cabinet before midnight tonight.
Secretary of State Powell says the U.S. will not be blackmailed by nuclear threats from North Korea after the two nations met in Beijing. General Jay Garner takes the reins in Iraq and says he's optimistic about how things are progressing. Donald Rumsfeld says more of the most wanted members of Saddam Hussein's regime are surrendering or being captured. Former Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz was among those apprehended this week. The Premier of Ontario, Ernie Eves, protests the World Health Organization decision to warn against unnecessary travel to Toronto after the SARS outbreak there. President Bush takes to the road to push his $726 billion tax cut plan. Meanwhile, Dick Gephardt distinguishes himself from the other Democratic presidential candidates this week by calling for health insurance for all Americans. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says President Bush will nominate Alan Greenspan to another term as Fed chairman, and the Palestinians agree on a new cabinet, paving the way for the release of the so-called roadmap to peace. Jack Beatty, what should we take note of as we head to the weekend?
Well, I think the Dick Gephardt's announcement is the biggest political event of the year, and it's probably going to shape the rest of the Democratic primary campaign, or at least shape it for a long time. Gephardt has basically said that the Bush tax cut should be on the ballot, and voters should be able to choose whether they want that tax cut or whether they want to insure every person in America. And that includes a lot of people who just change jobs. A third of Americans every year are uninsured for some period in changing one job or another.
Tell us how the Gephardt plan differs from Bill Clinton's.
Well, it differs in this way. Bill Clinton's plan was put together by policy wonks in secret, and it had an almost Ptolemaic, epicyclic complexity. There were worlds within worlds of complexity in it. I think the thing was 1,300 pages when it was written. Gephardt's plan is a plan put forward by a politician. And what it does is it essentially does not change this current system. Clinton's plan was killed off by big lobbyists, big pharma, big hospitals, big insurance. Gephardt's plan wouldn't disturb them at all. Gephardt, because he allows corporations to write off 60% of their medical expenses, would have lobbyists from corporations. Because labor unions and all workers might be able to get raises, since corporations would have so much more money, that will have unions. So he's got built a kind of political juggernaut here that Clinton almost left politics out, strangely enough, of that plan, and it doomed it. And, you know, what Gephardt is saying is, do you want the $800? That's what most Americans would get from all of the Bush tax cuts. Paul Krugman estimates $800 a year. Do you want that, or do you want the assurance of medical insurance? And, of course, you know, you can't buy a policy for $800 a year. And that same tax cut would give the top 1% $80,000 a year.
Earlier this week, Newt Gingrich, who's still around Washington as a member of the Defense Advisory Board, delivered a speech that was quite critical of Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, criticizing Powell for 6 months of diplomatic failures. What should we make of that?
It's an extraordinary development, isn't it? As you say, Gingrich is a member of that defense board, and more than that, he's a close friend of Donald Rumsfeld. And nobody in Washington doubts but that Rumsfeld okayed that speech. So then you have to say, why would Donald Rumsfeld want publicly to basically be seen to be pushing Colin Powell out of the administration? And the only thing that makes sense to me about this, other than that Mr. Rumsfeld is an imperious character who obviously wants to run anything he can be near, the only thing that makes sense to me is that this is really about North Korea. We know what Rumsfeld wants to do there. He had a memo leaked this week. He wants to topple the North Korean regime, which would mean, well, subversion at a minimum, war at more likely. Powell, we know what he wants to do. He even back in 2001 wanted to continue the Clinton policy of accommodation. And I think that this is really pushing Colin Powell to the point where he's got to ask himself, if they're going to go ahead with the Rumsfeld idea, can I stay in office or should I resign on principle and take this to the country? Something to watch.
We're just about out of time. I'm wondering very quickly, do you think that should there be a second Bush 2 term, that Colin Powell will be a part of it?
I would really doubt it now, just given the kind of treatment he's been getting. I mean, he was damned with faint praise. Fleischer called him, he said, an able diplomat. That's not to say much, is it?
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
And you too.
I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by